This is the course on St. Francis, the first session. My name is Stuart Taylor, and usually in the kind of education that I've been a part of is weekend retreats, and we would spend the whole first several hours just getting to know each other. So it seems a little unnatural in a way that I'm introduced to you and it's not reciprocal, but so be it in an hour. I do want to begin, though, in good Socratic fashion with a question and ask you about your heroes and heroines as you were growing up. Did you have them? And who was your hero? Who was your heroine as you were growing up? Somebody just volunteer if some name comes to mind or person.
When does it count? How far growing up?
All the way back.
All the way forward, though?
All the way forward, sure. Well, who was your hero?
Paul Tillich, for a long time.
Paul Tillich?
Jackie Robinson.
Lassie.
Who was it?
Lassie.
I like the park ranger. I really thought I wanted to be a park ranger.
Oh, no, I go way back before that.
Okay.
I'm too old for that. The real
Albert Schweitzer. Albert Schweitzer.
I like S.I. Hayakawa. I didn't have a hero until I contacted him.
I'll give an ice cream cone to anyone here who can guess who my hero is. Now, I'm a 10th generation South Carolinian, so that's the clue I'm giving you. Free ice cream cone rides on a guess.
John C. Calhoun.
That's a good guess, but wrong.
Swamp Fox,
Francis Marion. He was definitely one of them.
Okay, not him. No, the other guy.
Robert E. Lee. Did you say Robert? Robert E. Lee. So you get the. Do you want to collect now, or could we do it afterwards?
All
right. Robert E. Lee was my hero growing up. All Southern boys in the South were raised on stories of the Northern War of Aggression against the Southern states for independence and the achievements. And I never could figure out how it was that we could whip the Yankees in every battle and still lose the war. I mean, how did Grandpa? I mean, that it just doesn't add up. I don't know. But that's the funny thing and the problematic thing about heroes, I think, in the sense that our heroes sometimes betray us. They put us in contradictory situations where our values are in conflict. We outgrow our heroes. Our vision of life expands, moves on, matures, and we begin to look to other persons or figures who somehow express or articulate our vision of life. And that's why I think the whole question of heroism is not just a thing of a nostalgia for our childhood, but it's an important theological question today. Where do we see the human life being lived to the fullest in a way that strikes us as one with integrity, wholeness? The question of heroism, I think, is preeminently a theological question. Frankly, though, Francis was never one of my heroes. I guess, like all of you, I remember seeing him sitting out there in the garden beside the bird bath, behind the fake deer, you know. It's like that was my image of Francis, and it's almost like the first task we have to do here to really get at Francis is to let go of this sentimental caricature that we have of Francis, which is kind of the sweet, well-intentioned nature mystic who was bouncing around, tra-la-la-la-la. And there's a little bit of that in Francis, but there's so much more that I think it's best to kind of wipe the slate clean and come to Francis as if you've never heard of him before. The problem with heroes in a religious tradition is that we promote them to saints, and we kick them out of human experience, in a sense, and make them into ideals of perfection that none of us have a prayer, literally, of fulfilling. And we don't want to do that with Francis. We don't want to create some otherworldly ideal that has nothing to do with, no intersection with our own experience. And so what we will be doing in exploring the biography of Francis is using that biography as a springboard for our theological reflection about what it means to be a human being, not in the first century or the 11th century, but in the 20th century, on the edge of a new millennium. What does it mean to be a human being and living out our faith in this world as we find it? As the Nicaraguans in the base communities that I had the privilege to encounter over a few years would talk about it as the emergence of the nuevo hombre and the nueva mujer, the new man and the new woman. And that was the central line of discourse. Everywhere you went in Nicaragua, it seemed like in the newspapers, in the worship services, in the fields, in the factories, people were talking about the new man, the new woman of the revolution. And I think that's what we're doing in looking back to Francis. We're trying to get some clues about the new man and the new woman that needs to emerge and is emerging in our time and place now on the edge of a new millennium. So I want to acknowledge text that has been very, very important in my understanding of Francis. A couple people have asked me, are you an expert on Francis? And I'm not. I really am. It's only been in the last few years. I had a spiritual director who was a Franciscan who introduced me to some of his writings and writings about him. And then most recently, finding Leonardo Boff's book on St. Francis, which is available in the bookstore, and they have about 10 copies. So I really commend this book to you. And most of what we'll be doing in this week will be kind of an explication or taking what Boff has done a few steps further. Why don't we first began as a learning community to kind of pool our wisdom and our ignorance about Francis. Where was he born?
Italy.
What town?
Venice.
Assisi? I've heard over here Assisi. St. Francis of Assisi. It's a central Italian town in the province of Umbria, a very, in Francis's day, very wild country of craggy mountains and rushing rivers and beautiful plains. It's still to this day a very beautiful, dominantly agricultural province. Let's see, what year was Francis born? What century first? 12th century. Actually got it right up here, don't we? Does anyone know anything about the circumstances into which Francis was born?
Very wealthy.
Son of a
cloth merchant.
Party boy.
His father was the Bernardone family. They were cloth merchants. They were a part of an emerging middle class in Italy that was asserting itself over against the nobility, a new kind of power base in Italy at that time. It was a time of flux and transition in Europe and certainly in Italy. And Francis, and through his father, was exposed to ideas and customs from all over Europe. His father, in fact, traded in France, had a kind of a love affair with French custom and language, and named his son Francis in honor of France. As folks have said, he was very, very wealthy. What's the image that we have of the young Francis? Now, we're talking way before conversion and everything that we know him for, but what was the image? What did he look like? Does anybody have a...
He was
And everybody starts looking over there.
That number is wrong.
Is it? 1182 is...
Their clothes are really big.
He was a fancy dresser.
I mean, I think part of the culture.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And he did things to excess.
That's right. He was kind of a libertine. He was definitely a party boy. He wasn't very impressive physically or his appearance. In fact, one of the later brothers, who was actually a very handsome man, Brother Maceo, would say, why do they run after this guy? I mean, he was kind of homely, pretty small. But he had a spirit about him. He was very fun-loving. He loved to sing. He loved to party. He was kind of the life of the party. He had a lot of friends. Everybody knew him in town. And he was always throwing parties because he had the dough. And so that was one reason he was probably pretty popular. As much as he went through his father's money very quickly. As much as he was a party boy, he was also a very courteous individual. All the historical accounts say that he was a very gentle person and very, very courteous and sensitive to other people. And that's from the earliest accounts of... What happened? What were some of the things that happened to Francis before conversion? What were some of the major events in his early life?
Went to war.
He went to war. Now, some of you who know Italian history better than I do know that the city-states in Italy were constantly, I mean, it was almost a constant state of war, of tension. Francis got swept up in a war between Assisi and a neighboring town, Perugia, I think is the name of it. He went off in all this idealism and confidence and arrogance of youth in a small military band, was captured, thrown into prison, and stayed there for a year. He actually contracted some kind of disease from that time in prison, and when he was finally released and exchanged for prisoners, he had basically a physical breakdown, perhaps a mental breakdown as well. He was in convalescing from his time in prison for at least a year after he was released. Interesting story, though. Apparently, his military squad or whatever was betrayed by someone within the group, and this person was ostracized by the rest of the captives. And everyone, no one would talk to him except Francis. And Francis seemed to be going through some kind of experience of just euphoria in prison until his health broke down completely. He was always kind of trying to cheer people up, to attend to their needs, to be kind of the optimist. And he probably was pretty obnoxious, actually, I'm sure, in that state of, in the back of a jail cell, Francis would not be one you'd hang out with too much. That was a very, very important event in his life, the war, the prison, and the sickness. Following that was a period of depression, of aimlessness, of trying to find, what is my focus? His father and Francis, the only thing they seemed to agree on was that he should be a knight. And so Francis was constantly toying with this idea of going off and achieving glory and fame and becoming a knight, through warfare and becoming a knight. And this, his father also wanted to support this because it was his ticket into another kind of level of respectability in Assisi. So, but this was constantly, this dream of glory was constantly being refuted by forces within Francis's life that he wasn't really conscious of. In fact, he went off one time and got sick again, apparently before he'd recovered from his illness. Got sick again, sold this very expensive set of armor that his father had forked out a lot of dough for, and then returned to town in disgrace, and basically didn't have a clue what he was up to. He would go out and take long, he would disappear for days at a time. He would stay by himself. All his party friends tried to draw him out, and there was no doing that. He was really in a period of crisis. Then we come to the process of his conversion, and like all of us, I think there's no one peculiar moment. I think there were several key events. Can any of you recall or think of any of those key moments in his conversion process? Does anything come to mind? The leper, yes. Francis was, like any of us, I think, was absolutely revolted by the sight of lepers who passed by. And I'm sure it was a pretty hideous sight. Since they were uncared for. And he saw one day and rode on past and then turned around and came back and embraced the leper. And this is a very, very key moment in his life, in his faith journey, and we'll come back to that in this session perhaps, or other sessions, what that meant for him. Another key moment was when he in a very a fit of impetuosity, just took some of his father's finest garments and material and went and sold them at the market and took and gave all the money to the poor. And he did this, obviously, against his father's wishes. And his father had him hauled in, locked up, and appeal to the bishop, who was also the adjudicator of legal questions as well as religious questions. There wasn't quite that distinction in that day as there is now. And so they came before the bishop in the bishop's courtyard, and the father was pleading his case, this ungrateful son who would actually try to undermine his father's business and behave in this irresponsible way. And Francis finally, in so many words, said, "You are no longer my father. I no longer have any claim on you. You have no claim on me." And he, in a very literal but in a very highly symbolic way, took off his clothes in the middle of the courtyard in front of the town, and on a winter day. I mean, this is a very, very serious action, and in a sense, Francis was, this was a crucifixion experience. He was relinquishing all of ordinary life. He was letting go of family, of security, of status, reputation, his economic place in the community, everything. He was letting go of that, and this was a pivotal moment in his life. And perhaps what we think of when we think of Francis's conversion experience. I think it's very important to reflect on this, that conversion for Francis, a middle class person, was relinquishment, was a letting go of all that encumbered him. And I hope we can come back to that. The encounter with the leper, and then the vision that he had in a time of prayer, where he heard a voice say to him, "Francis, look, behold my church, it is in ruins. Rebuild my church, rebuild my house." And Francis took this vision as a very literal command to rebuild a small chapel that had fallen into disrepair. It's called San Damiano. You can still go to it outside of Assisi, and he took it upon himself to rebuild this small chapel, and so began his career as a saint, walking around Assisi in nothing but a rag, begging for stones so that he could rebuild this church. Then we go on to the rest of his life. We have the first followers who join him. Bernard, who was a businessman who somehow went insane and decided that this, there was something about this Francis that he was also willing to give up everything and go and join him, the first follower. There was another, the second follower was Peter, was a church official, highly placed, had tremendous authority in his community, was willing to lay that all aside and go and follow Francis, be with Francis. And the three of them took up a ministry in a leper colony, and they built a little lean-to on the side of a, the place where the lepers lived, and they ministered to the lepers, and they rebuilt three churches. And this was the start of this incredible movement of three men, three brothers, living in a rock shed on the side of a leper colony.
Were any of them married?
Later on, a number of them.
Not before.
Not at this point.
So they did not relinquish family, wives, things like that.
That's right. At that point. Later on, that question became very a very critical question, and they initiated a whole lay movement for Mary. There were a lot of things. What do you when you think of Francis, what do you associate about his, what comes to mind when you think of his ministry or his life, his vocation? What are the things that that come to mind immediately?
I'd say he was sold out. Just totally committed to, sold out and committed to what he believed in.
And
it'd be hard to believe everything he had.
An absolute dedication and passion to his work, his calling.
Expressed in Lady Poverty.
Right, a commitment to poverty, to simplicity. That was actually even controversial among his peers. Francis, later in his life, was really struggled with the disagreement among other Franciscans, others of that way, who disagreed on the lengths to which he would commit himself and others and his community to poverty. That was very, very controversial, even to Franciscans. What else do you associate with Francis?
I keep seeing birds and animals all around him. I mean, there's this picture that's always in my head when I think of Francis. He was communing with nature and had such a gentle spirit that the animals themselves would just be very comfortable with him.
And I think that's a real, you know, it's funny, a lot of the legends about Francis, you're not sure how much to believe and how much is really historical, but the more I read, the more I begin to kind of doubt my own doubts. There's a sense in which anything is possible with this person. Some things are pretty clearly legend, and a lot of other things that we kind of put in the category of legend, I'm not sure anymore. You know, there's this famous story of how there was a wolf that was terrorizing a village, and apparently Francis was able to tame the wolf in a sense, and bring the wolf in so that it was almost became a companion to this village. The fact that he would preach to birds seems a little loony to me, but I'd like to have seen it. He certainly took a delight in the physical landscape of Umbria, of Italy. He loved light. He loved the sunlight. He loved the sound of water. He loved the feel of earth in his hands. He loved to climb among rocks and in caves. He was someone in love with creation. I think that's a fair statement about Francis. What else do you associate with Francis?
Stigmata, but that came quite regularly.
That's right. That's right. I think one of the most important things to understand about Francis was his devotion to the historical Jesus. His re- he was constantly trying to imitate the historical Jesus in his own life. And he felt very strongly that the gospel was something to be lived quite literally in the fashion of Jesus and the apostles. And he his identification with Christ was so complete at the end of his life that at a period of intense spiritual trial and solitude, he actually experienced the wounds of Christ being formed into his own body. His hands and feet and side were pierced. Now this can easily be dismissed by modern skeptics as, you know, a legend. And yet we have very good record that he actually tried to conceal these wounds from display. After that point, he often kept his hands and feet wrapped because it was just something that he wasn't sure how people would receive it, what they would make of it. I don't find that hard to believe myself that happened. There was also an interesting, his whole relationship to the established church was an interesting thing in an age in which there were 101 schismatic movements. Everybody was going off and forming new cults or new movements that were outside the church and repudiated the church. The very interesting thing about Francis is that he initiated a very radical movement that challenged the church to the core, and yet he never once questioned his loyalty to the church. He was clearly a part of the church. That's a very important issue, I think, for us today, because there's so many movements in American life and religious life of repudiating the church and moving out into new experiences of community and religious faith, and yet it's very difficult sometimes to maintain that connection to the established church. I sense that tension at times, that ambivalence that a lot of us have about the established church.
What was going on in the church in the 12th century that there were so many of these schismatic movements and people going?
Well, we have to remember that at that point, the church was already a very ancient institution. I mean, it was celebrating over 1,000 years being there, and so it was I guess that there was an experience of the church as lifeless, of tradition that the spirit had gone out of a lot of the tradition. There was a lot of corruption among clergy. The Vatican had been discredited in many ways because in previous popes because of its political dealings. So the church was in a time, in a need for renewal, in a period of entropy and emptiness. The thing that, the other fascinating story, and I needed to find out more about this, but apparently Francis accompanied the first crusaders to the Middle East and was very, very disillusioned. I mean, they all left with ideals in the foreground with their banners, and Francis became very, very disillusioned with the Crusades, obviously, as he saw first the behavior of the crusaders in their camps as they moved toward the Middle East, then their repression of the people in the countries. And then, of course, this famous story of how he went out from the Crusaders' camp, crossed the lines, and actually entered into dialogue with the leadership of the so-called heathen, the infidels. He was actually in the camp of the enemy, and was no one can quite figure out how he wasn't killed, but somehow he was recognized for a person of God. And was allowed to talk with the Sultan for days, and then was allowed to return to the Crusaders' camp, which is an incredible story.
They use them right now.
Yeah. The thing that comes to my mind when I think of Francis and his biography is the kind of nickname that he got was that he was called God's Fool. I'm sure it was first just fool, and then he maybe later on they promoted him to God's fool, because, I mean, really, what he did was very scandalous to his community, and I'm sure similar actions in our young people or in any at any age would seem scandalous to us. I mean, you could point to any number of stories. Well, the one we've already spoken of, Francis stripping naked in the courtyard, his preaching to birds and talking to animals. I mean, there's a famous story about Francis one night woke up the whole town of Assisi ringing the bell. I mean, he was that kind of fool. And there's something about, oh, I've got to tell you the story I like the most. He went to Rome to get an audience with the Pope to get official recognition for his order, this new order that was just taking off by leaps and bounds. And apparently he comes in, and then the Pope is before him, and the Pope goes, "Whoa, what is that smell?" And Francis kind of looks up sheepishly, and the Pope says, "Well, why don't you just go roll in a pigsty?" And Francis, eager to please, goes, "Got it," and turns around, heads out, goes and rolls in a pigsty, and then comes back. And he was such a literal, simple person, wanting to, an obedient person, in the sense of wanting to respond to the Pope's wishes. And the Pope, of course, was being sarcastic, but it didn't make any, it made matters much worse, I'm sure.
What was the source of remembrances like that?
Pardon me?
What's the source of, you know, stories like that?
Well, a lot of his contemporaries wrote histories or biographies. His first, Bernard, wrote a history of his life. And then there are records in Assisi. I mean, there are Franciscans definitely chronicled every step of the way. But this image of the fool is one that I think is an important, it's an important tradition that Francis is guiding us into, a rich symbol or archetype. And when I say archetype, I mean kind of a primordial pattern or a way of being. The fool has a rich history in our own, in Christianity. I mean, we think of Jesus, who was accused of being possessed, insane, a party boy as well, a blasphemer. We think of Paul and his words into the First Corinthians. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. This is a very, very powerful tradition of the foolishness of God, or the fools of God, that I think provide a very, very important clue about the new man and the new woman that need to emerge in our time. And I want to just there's enough here about the fool that we could have done a whole week on this alone, but I just want to give you, kind of whet your appetite for a little bit about this tradition, and maybe there's ways in which we could come back to this. But Saint Basil in Russia, this saint who used to steal merchandise from dishonest merchants, who would throw rocks at the houses of the rich folks, who wept with sinners and who denounced the Tsar. Who was it who was that fellow who said, "Sin boldly and but believe more boldly still"? I think I believe it was Martin Luther. I think he would probably count himself within this tradition. Outside of the Christian tradition, you have In Jewish tradition, you have the village idiot, who was never completely dismissed, who was always not only tolerated, but accepted in the village life as a mouthpiece of God. You have the medieval custom of the court jester, the jester whose service to the king and to the queen was to ridicule everything that happened in the court so that the king and the queen would not take themselves too seriously.
Native Americans had that too. They're what they called contraries, people who'd be naked in the wintertime and horribly clothed in the summer, and they'd walk backwards and stick their hands in the fire and someone else would. And they were valued members of the community. So
I didn't know that.
Universal.
Lisa and I went to a Native American dance, a corn dance in New Mexico a month or so ago, and it was this most sacred moment in the year of the Indian village, and yet throughout the dance, which lasted all day, there were fools, clowns, who would mock the whole proceeding. It was like, in any time we go about the business of being sacred, we need to have some voice in the background keeping it in perspective. Someone laughing, saying, "This is not sacred. This is still human." And that's the role of the fool or the shaman. I think in contemporary terms, I think of Charlie Chaplin as a very Franciscan person. And I was with my in-laws in Phoenix, and they had videotaped a lot of his movies. So I, for the first time ever, had gotten to see a lot of the Chaplin films. And this, I think of this little clown who you always found him among the unemployed. He was often in mental institutions. He was in the streets among the homeless. He was with orphans. He was with factory workers. He was with the grunts in the trenches at wartime. He was among criminals, revolutionaries. This fool whose artistry embraced both the comic and the tragic. This fool who was always wandering, the itinerant, you know, you remember the little fedora and the cane? It's kind of the Franciscan itinerant. This fool who was the loving adversary of the police, of the rich, of all systems of power. And that's an element to the Chaplin films that I don't think we pay enough attention to. That Chaplin was always the little fool, the little clown, or the little hobo, I guess it was always somehow in an adversarial relation with some system of power. I think that we need to, as we consider, the new person, the new human being that God is fashioning in our time and place to respond to these critical challenges that we face as Christians and as people of faith, that we need to reckon on this image of the fool. We need to reflect on what this means for us as people of faith. I think what this means is that truth for us as people of faith will never come from the center where everything is acceptable, where everything is understood and clearly and logically articulated. Truth for us in the Franciscan mode will come from the periphery. It will come from outside the fringes of the acceptable. Truth will come to us in a foolish way because it will pretend to be subversive. It will overturn accepted ways of thinking, accepted ways of behaving. It will challenge the status quo. It will be foolish enough to say, "There's another way." I think to enter into the foolishness of God is to see the integral relation between comedy and tragedy. The tragedy of the cross and the comedy of the resurrection are held together in one life, in one expression. I think to enter into the foolishness of God with Francis is to learn how to laugh and to cry again. It is to enter into a second innocence, to recover our childhood. I think to enter into the foolishness of God with Francis is to be willing to take risk. It is to be the willingness to let go of ourselves and to take new forms and to experiment with new ways of being. To enter into the foolishness of God with Francis is to dare to believe the most preposterous thing of all, and that is that we actually matter, that our individual lives and our community lives can make a difference in this world that we live in. And that is the most comic, preposterous supposition that you can ever make. But that's what Francis is about, and that's what I think the church is about. I hope that if you feel enticed enough to come to another session, that we can name and release the fool in each of us and explore what that could mean for our Christian identity. I hope that we can find forgiveness for those parts of ourselves that we have rejected and deemed unacceptable, and see those parts of ourselves as resources for our spiritual renewal. I hope that we can learn not to take ourselves so seriously and to take ourselves more seriously. I hope that we can dare to believe, to really believe with Francis, that the gospel story is meant to be lived out in very concrete, very literal ways. I hope you'll come back. Over the next few days, we're going to be looking at Francis in relation to the poor and looking for clues about how that might inform our relationship to the poor. And what does our relationship to the poor mean for our Christian identity? We'll be looking at Francis in relation to the church, to the community of faith. What kind of community of faith did Francis create and call into being? And how could that inform our experience or lack of experience of community in the church? We'll be looking at Francis in relation to the feminine and the whole relationship of Francis and Claire. And what does that mean about the creation of just and peaceful relations between the genders? What does that mean about psychic healing for ourselves as we try to find as men try to find integration with the feminine within themselves, and as women try to find integration with the masculine within themselves? We will also look at Francis and look to him as a teacher in the problem of human suffering. And we will look at that from a range of experiences in terms of suffering is kind of an umbrella, but we'll look at try to look at things like what does it mean to take up the cross, dealing with one's dark side, embracing our finitude. We'll define that together, that agenda. Next week, all next week, if for those of you who are around, we'll be looking at the Canticle to Creation, the famous Canticle to Brother Son that Francis wrote. And each day we'll be looking at a different verse, and Brother Sun, Sister Moon, Brother Wind, Sister Water, Brother Fire, Sister Earth, and looking at those archetypes as having a cosmic meaning, but also having a very deeply spiritual and interior meaning. So that's kind of an overview. Each day it won't be exactly like this. I hope it won't be all lecture or me talking at you. I really hope that we can do some one-on-one stuff, small group, some experiential learning together about Francis. Again, we're not going to be delving into this personality cult about Francis, but using Francis and his life as a springboard into radical discipleship and what that means for us. So, thank you all for coming. I can't believe it. I never thought I would get through all this in an hour, but I'm actually ahead of time. Are any comments or questions or things you'd like?
About the beginning of his ministry, he was born in 1182. How old was he when he renounced his father and society and went out to do his own thing?
I have got, thank you for asking that question, because I've got a brief chronology of his life that is available. We have limited copies, so I'd make these available to you if you think it would be useful to you, one per family, and particularly if you think you're going to come back, you're welcome to these. The answer to the question, let's see, I think he was in his early 20s, but... he was born in 1182. He had his courtyard encounter with the bishop in 1206. So what is that?
24.
Any other comments or, yes?
Have you seen the movie Brother, Son, Sister, Moon?
Yeah, a long time ago. Have you seen it? I saw it as a teenager, and I was very moved by it, but I haven't seen it. And have you? You've seen it.
Stuart, the village has it.
Really?
Oh, really?
Who said that? Jack?
It's a wonderful movie.
Maybe we could figure out a time. I'll talk with Jackie and Dan, and maybe we can figure out a time to show it.
It feels to me, from what you're saying, it's a very accurate description of the movie.
That would be great.
So they'd be interested in seeing that, if we could work it out?
I've seen the movie, too. It'd be like, it's an overview. You know, it can only cover so much in the movie.
Other?
Have you read the Collins Office trailer?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess the Collins Office one, to me, captured something that really bothers me, and I wonder if you haven't asked for this, but I've been bothered by this for years. Francis' love of nature, his love of the earth, and yet this incredible ascetic side. It seems so contradictory, because Christ was accused of being a wine bibber and all this stuff, you know. And yet when Collins' office tried to follow Christ, he didn't have any of this joy and appreciation and of the natural world and the gifts of God in the natural world. I mean, he loved it, but he didn't allow himself to enjoy it and enter into it. And this lack of enjoyment, this constant punishment, I just couldn't reconcile that. Have you come to any?
You know, another biography that I recommend, this Chesterton, his little biography of Francis. Let me read a paragraph to you that's in the front page. Francis is first and foremost a paradox. He is he holds so many opposites together in unity. This is very quick. We may at least get a glimmering of why the poet who praised his Lord the Sun often hid himself in a dark cavern, of why the saint who was so gentle with his brother the wolf was so harsh to his brother the ass, as he nicknamed his own body, of why the troubadour who said that love set his heart on fire separated himself from women, of why the singer who rejoiced in the strength and gaiety of the fire deliberately rolled himself in the snow, of why the very song which cries with all the passion of a pagan, "Praise be God for our sister, Mother Earth, which brings forth varied fruits and grass and growing flowers," ends almost with the words, "Praise be God for our sister, the death of our body, sister death." I can't explain those paradoxes, and I don't think you can ever explain paradoxes, but maybe with Chesterton and through this week, we'll get a glimmer of how Francis did embody what are some of the fundamental paradoxes of the faith, of, for instance, the spirit of the ascetic, of renouncing all things, and yet having them come back and to be able to enjoy them, enjoy all things. He was a hedonist and an ascetic. I mean, it's an amazing thing, but he has some secrets that I think we need to be attentive to. Other comments? Questions?
What makes you think a new man is emerging?
What was the question?
What makes you think a new man is emerging. I think every age is given the task of reclaiming for itself what is the essence of Christian faith, and to live that out in dialogue with its own time and place in response to the challenges of that day. I see that as particularly urgent in our time. Every age is also said we're the last age, but this age truly is apocalyptic in the sense of the stakes, and that we have to be about this business of creating a new human being, or we're going to destroy the very home we have on this planet, unless we come about creating a new consciousness of what it means to be human. The global, the ecological crisis, the political crisis, all of these things tell me that we have to be about this, and that God is giving us the grace to remake the world in this time and place. Do you think there's a new?
Well, should and is are not the same.
No, they're not. But I do believe and maybe we'll have a chance to talk about this, the time I've spent in Nicaragua, that's one, in Central America, that's one place where I see a new human being created. And that gives me so much hope that among the poorest of the poor, there is this power that has been being unleashed for a new creation. So it's not just a sense of we've got to do something now, it's a sense that there is a grace being given to respond to that challenge. Yes, ma'am.
In San Francisco, Bufano took guns and he made a big statue of St. Francis of Assisi. And he made it at the San Francisco airport. And so he was remaking peace.
I would encourage you, if you have any resources or poems or things that you'd like to introduce into our time together, music, we're going to be trying to do that. I meant to bring some Paul Winter music for our closing today, and I forgot it, but I'll try.
So I don't know if this fits into this session or not, but one thing I haven't quite understood. I grew up Catholic, and Francis was a big part of my growing up. I think in the Catholic Church, you hear about Francis a lot, even if it is only the garden statues, but Francis is present. But I've spent the last 15 years mostly hanging around Protestants, and Francis isn't accepted. I mean, we sang his canticle last night in Vespers, and you hear about him a little bit here, but I don't get the sense that Protestants think much about Francis in terms of their heritage. Maybe I'm wrong. If I'm wrong in that, please correct my perception. But I'm wondering why that's the case, or if that's the case even. I don't think much about saints, period. But I know, but I mean, like Augustine, I hear a lot about Augustine in Protestant circles. He's a head man.
I think it's the Protestant reaction to hagiography or the semi-worship of saints, and so we throw the baby out with the bathwater, and we eliminate a whole important tradition or resource for the renewal of the church by keeping ourselves in the dark and the ignorance about the whole tradition of saints or men and women who have lived the faith to the fullest. I mean, that's the most important resource we have. Biography is theology. Thank you all.